Okay. Okay, everybody. It's nice to be here learning together with you people. I wanted to take up the matter of the spies, the Meraglim. You know, over the years we've done it. I mean, I've done it anyways, and it's good to go back after a number of years and to sort of like fine tune certain points and so on and so forth. It's a very fascinating story, and it's very complicated. It's something which I would say is completely unexpected. It's not the kind of thing you expect to be happening. You know, when we look at the, you know, the story of the Jews and Eretz Mitzrayim, and then you have the Exodus, and all right, Kriyas Yamsuf, so you have a number of things occur. But now it seems like smooth sailing. You know, Moshe says to Yisro, "No simanachnu, we're going to be traveling." So this part, you think Hashem is going to lead them, and it's going to be beautiful, and it's going to be a glorious conquest of the land. It's completely unexpected what happens. Now, before we go any further, it's important to realize that the story is told in two places. If you want to get the full picture, you have to study it here in Shalach. Okay, Shalach, we'll be reading Shalach next week. I think you guys will be reading it 2 weeks from now. But it's not the complete story in Shalach, because it's also a lot of significant information is contained in Devarim. It's pretty much the first subject that Moshe takes up in Devarim, where he's basically being mochiach, he's rebuking the people for their averos, and he highlights the sin of the spies, and he provides additional information. So you have to study both, and you have to weave the points, the story together. So for example, if you just read Shalach, it would appear that it's the command of Hashem, that Hashem initiates it, it's the will of God that they should send spies. Okay, however, if you go to Devarim, and you'll see that it was not from Hashem. That this really was at the initiative of the people themselves. And the beginning of the Devarim, you have Perek Aleph, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, where Moshe tells them that Hashem has placed the land before you. Alei Reish, go up and conquer. It's a question whether that's a mitzvah saseh for all the Doras to go up and conquer Israel. The Ramban holds that way. But as God said, "Al tiravi al teichas, do not be afraid." Then Moshe says, "But tikru and elai kulcham." This is not recorded in Shalach. And all the people gathered together by Moshe, and they said, "Nishlcha anashim lefanenu, let us send out the people before us." V'yachpul lanu es haaretz. They'll dig out, they'll search out the land, and they'll bring us back a report. The derech. The roads, you know, the approaches, how we should conduct the invasion, and the cities that we should come to. This basically seems like practical, I would say, military information. Then it says, "Vayitav bi'en hadav." Apparently Moshe had no thought or no intention to send spies, and Hashem certainly hadn't told him to do it. But Moshe said that the matter was good in my eyes. And then I picked from you 12 men, each for every shevet had its man, and then he goes on to further. So that's a very vital piece of information that you wouldn't be able to understand what's going on without that. And also another piece of information comes out over here too in the Devarim account, and that is in the Shalach account we see that the spies came back with their report, and then it was a negative report. And then, of course, we have to understand why. The Ramban asked that question. What did they say that was wrong? Apparently, they spoke the truth. So what was their sin? That's a big question. What was the sin of the spies? But you don't see Moshe getting involved. They were counted by Yoshua and Kalev, mainly Kalev. They tried to refute them. And then, you know, the people are going up and back, and they're wavering, and then basically the spies come out with another twist, another angle. But you don't see Moshe getting involved. However, that's not the case, because in the account in Devarim, you see that Moshe does get involved, and he speaks to them. He tries to do whatever he could to salvage the situation. Unfortunately, nothing helps. All right, so we have to see if we can understand that. Now, they threw the gauntlet at Moshe when they demanded spies. So then the question is, should he do it or shouldn't he do it? was that a good idea? So here you have a machlokus, and that is that the Ramban maintains that there was nothing wrong with the request for spies. In fact, he says that it was a good thing, because that's the way of the world. You can't rely on miracles. So if you're going to be engaged in an invasion, so you need the information. In fact, you see, 40 years later, before the actual conquest, the invasion, that Yoshua sent out spies. He sent out spies. That's really, you could ask the question, of course, given all the aggravation that the first mission caused, you'd think that maybe they'd be leery about having another spy mission, but clearly that spy mission was different. This was an unusual kind of a spy mission. That was different because there he only sent two people and they reported, they didn't give a report to the entire nation. See, a lot of things you learn. That's a big problem also, is why the spies were allowed to address the entire nation. It seems that Moshe didn't know what was coming. This is a question that's been bothering me for years. I try to suggest possible answers in that it just boggles the mind. Normally, on a mission like this, when they come back, they're going to report to the leaders. At least first, report to the leaders. Then if the leaders feel that they should address the nation, or the leaders themselves will take that information and they'll address the nation. But here we see they come back and it would appear that they go right to the microphone and they address the people. To me, that's a significant question. I'll suggest certain possibilities when we get there. By the way, I'm going to throw out a bunch of questions, and sometimes in the exposition, I may forget to come back to a question and tie that in. So remind me, please, if I left that addressing a question that I raised. So I just want to establish certain basic questions that we're going to try to address. As I said, Rashi holds that Moshe, this is not recorded in the Torah, that Moshe was nimlach by Kodesh Baruch Hu, that Moshe consulted God, what should I do? So you see, it wasn't such a simple thing, whether they should appoint spies. As I said, Ramban disagrees, but Rashi holds that Moshe was nimlach by Hashem, he consulted God. And he got a very unanticipated, a very strange answer. Because God said, do what you want. It's up to you. I'm not going to guide you in this one, which is very fascinating. Because we assume that whenever we address God, God's going to answer. He's going to tell us what to do. It's not necessarily the case. Sometimes the answer is, use your own judgment. But Rashi adds another piece to that. And that is he has Hashem, the Chazal. It's from Chazal, the Pikt Hashem. It's saying, I already told him it was a good land. I said, there's no need for spies. I told them the land is good. That's what Moshe came back from the Sneh, that I'm going to take them to a land which is Zavas Chalav Advash, which flows with milk and honey. So what do you need to see for yourself? But I'm going to give them an opening over here if you want to, if you have to, so go ahead. But as Moshe said, that it was good in his own eyes. It was good in his own eyes. Moshe's reaction, you see, it's the human reaction, even Moshe Rabbeinu is not the same as God's reaction. And that is, for Moshe, it was good. I suppose Moshe thought it was good because it shows that they're actively involved there. That's it. They're beginning the conquest. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now we notice certain other things, because I just mentioned that if it's a spying mission, so why do you have 12 men? That's a big group. That's a lot of people to be spying, and the danger of detection is very great, so why do you want to have to have 12 people? And then, in fact, that's what the initial answer of the brothers to Yosef was. Shame also with 12 brothers, well, one's missing, but it's very unusual for anybody to send out spies. We're not spies. You don't send out a family and such a large group who are obviously going to be noticed. But also, if you take a look at the instructions in Shalach, it's not just about military. It's about military considerations, clearly, but what it's also about topographical, agricultural information. What does that have to do with invading the land? I mean, as we said, Hashem said it's a good land. But secondarily, at least as many instructions pertaining to the topography. Is it good? Is it rich? Is it productive? And so on and so forth. So, of course, the question is, what's the idea behind that? And also, they're instructed to bring back the fruit of the land. This chazakdem, lakachdem, priyaretz. strengthen yourself. Apparently, this required a certain amount of courage. And as we see, there was a very unusual kind of fruit. And they had to carry it on staves, you know, on their shoulders. It wasn't simple kind of stuff. But what was the purpose of all of that? Okay. I want to ask another question. If you want to nail something down over here, what was the punishment? Okay, first off, this is Hashem threatened to destroy them. This was a very major rebellion on a par with the Chet HaEgel. And once again, Moshe, you know, prays before God, and he's able to prevent that, Hashem from carrying that out. But what was the punishment for the Chet HaMeraglim? Was that they would spend 40 years, I mean, an additional 39, but a total of 40 years in the wilderness until that entire generation passed away. But let me ask you a question. Was the punishment that they would not move forward until the entire generation that left Egypt from the age of 20 and up would pass away? So then why is it 40? Well, whatever happens, it could be 35, it could be 40, it could be 45. But you see, there is a point. It's not just that, because there is an idea of 40. So if you take a look at Shalach Bamidbar, in Perek Yudalit, you know, the story in Shalach. So, Pasuk Lamed Gimel, okay? In chapter Yudalit, Pasuk Lamed Gimel, Uvenechem Yiyu Roam Bamidbar Barm Shana. Your children will stray in the wilderness for 40 years. Venasu as the new Seichem. Atom Pigrechem Bamidbar, and they'll carry their guilt until they all die in the Midbar. V'mispar hayom ha'shatartem es'aretz. In other words, the number 40 is determined by the amount of days that you spied out the land. Arboim yom, the mission was 40 days. It's quite a lengthy mission. Yom lashana. Every day, they would suffer a year. In other words, the 40 years would recount the 40 days that they spent in spying out the land. Tisu asavon osechem, you'll carry your guilt, your sin. Arboim shana. 40 years, v'daitam es tenuasi, and you will know you'll comprehend the consequences of straying, of rebelling against Hashem. Okay. Additionally, trying to get out of all the questions I'm going to address. Additionally, in trying to understand the nature of the sin, what exactly was the sin? Was it that they were afraid? It seems like there was a national paralysis. Was fear, was that the other, that they should not have been afraid? And along with that, there's the factor that they lacked emunah. It seems that they lacked emunah in Hashem. That is, we can understand, if they hadn't been told that God was going to fight the war for them, if they were told that this is your responsibility to go up and invade, and then they sent spies, and then they saw these powerful giants, and they were afraid, that would be one thing. Okay, perhaps we can understand that. Maybe it would not be justified. Maybe they shouldn't be, because there are certain things that you have to do. And there are certain situations where you have to overcome your fear. Okay, but at least it would make sense to us. It would make sense to us because, people are human, and there's such a thing as fear. But what makes it very difficult to understand is that that's not what they were told. They weren't told that this is their war. They're going to have to win it on their own. They were told very clearly. And you'll see in Devarim, Moshe intervenes. And he reminds them of the fact that it's not you. Hashem is going to be fighting with you, fighting for you. So if that's the case, you have a guaranteed win. Hashem is not going to be defeated by the might of these inhabitants. So it makes it more difficult. I mean, God can't do this miracle. These people are too strong for God. How do you understand that, given that they had witnessed all the miracles of Hashem, the miracles that he performed in Mitzrayim, the miracles at the splitting of the Yam Suf, the destruction of the Egyptian expeditionary force? So they, well, what's special about this, about these giants? We saw these great, great giants. So what? For example, they had witnessed Makas Bechoros, the slaying of the firstborn. So God can do the same thing. Or God can bring in a plague. I mean, why did they suddenly think that maybe God couldn't, they weren't, and this thing you don't believe in God. Why? How do we understand that? Because it doesn't make sense. That's certainly not what I would expect. People who have seen all of this, all the power, the supreme power of HaKadosh Baruch Hu manifested in every possible way with the Bara and so on, the heavens above, the earth below, and so on and so forth. So why is this a problem? They should have just danced happily and go off into the into the invasion. Okay, we'll try to understand it. Additionally, there's the famous Rashi at the beginning of Shalach, which juxtaposes. Why is the Parsha of Shalach, the story of the Meraglim, juxtaposed to the story of Miriam? That's a famous Rashi, Chazal. So what does he say? He says that there is a connection, because they should have learned. The spies should have learned from what happened to Miriam. Miriam was punished because she spoke Lashon Hara about Moshe. Lefisha Loksa al Iske Diba. She was smitten because of matters of speech. She had Dibra B'Yachia. She spoke about her brother. Ushayim Halalu, and these wicked ones, Ra'u B'Lachu Musar. So you see that the Chiyav, by the way. There's a Chiyav when you see. That sounds very similar to the Chazal that says that someone who sees a Sota, the Kalkula, he should take a vow of Naziris. In other words, when you see what happens to Rishayim, and we're all, you know, Lashon Hara is always a big temptation, so you should have learned. You should have learned, you should pause. You see a lot of calamities happening. You shouldn't just say, oh my goodness, it's a terrible thing. But no, you should look within yourself and see to what extent do I partake of that same inclination, that same natiya, and what can I do? Because it could happen to me just as it happened to her. But apparently, they didn't do a tshuva. They committed the same avera. Yeah, but one second, how does that fit into the picture? First of all, the avera, they spoke badly about the land. That has to be understood. How does, you know, we associate Lashon Hara with defamation of character, which is always a prevalent thing. Talking about what do people like to talk about? What are the gossip columns all filled with is Lashon Hara. But it's not talking disparaging a land. And certainly if somebody comes back to he went on a trip somewhere to a country and he didn't like it and he has bad things to say about it, I don't think people would say, you know, that's Lashon Hara. So how does that fit into the picture of our understanding of Lashon Hara? But moreover, how does it fit into the story? Essentially, as I said, the story seems to be about a failure to rise to the occasion and to fear. They gave in to fear. That's clearly the obvious problem in the story, the matter of fear. And connected to that is a lack of amunah. True, we have to understand that. But where does Lashon Hara play a role? How does it work? How do these two things come together? Okay. Now, those are my basic questions. All right. I'm just going to throw in another one, which really I don't have to deal with, but it was on my mind. It's not exactly that connected. It's not essential to understanding the story of the spies, but I'm going to throw it in anyways. And that is the content, the subject matter of the conquest of the land. That seems to be a subject which was supposed to be included in Chamisha Chumshei Torah. It would have been included. So, for example, let's say you hadn't had this tragedy. Let's say the spies would have gone up and they would have come back and said everything. They would not have been intimidated. Let's say it's possible they had free will. Okay, let's say it would have turned out good and they all came back and they all spoke like Kalev and Yehoshua. So what would have happened next? The invasion. The people would have gone up and the people would have conquered. And where would we read about that? In Bamidbar. I imagine. I mean, it turned out bad. If it turned out good, but we've learned about the fact that the Jews actually did go and they did defeat the Canaanim and they. So now my question is like this: maybe it's not such a great question. I'm just going to throw it out there. So if that's the case, why isn't the ultimate, since the story of the conquest of the land is supposed to be part of Chamisha Chumshei Torah, because that's the whole the story of the creation of the Jewish people and the receiving of the Torah, the building of the Mishkan, and then entry into the land of Israel. When they finally entered into the land of Israel, they're not in Galus anymore. That's part of that's when the Chamisha Chumshei Torah is concluded, and then you go on to the next topic. So subsequently, when Yoshua actually conquered the land, why wasn't that included in Chamisha Chumshei Torah? Because why didn't the Torah continue till the and tell us the story? Why so it's not Moshe, it's Yoshua. And that story would have been included in Chamisha Chumshei Torah. And then you move on to Tanakh. Okay. I'll try and suggest something. Now let's get back to the issues over here. So the Ramban asks the question. Let's take a look at the Shalach. So they went up there. They went up there. And no, it tells you. Kalev apparently went to Hebron to Mishtatech. He stretched himself out in front of the kever of Avram, Avinu, and the others to gain strength. So then it says that they came back. This is in Perek Yud Gimel. Vayelchu vayavoa Moshe v'el Aaron v'el kaladas b'nei Yisrael. Okay, El Midbar Paran Kadesha. So they came back to Kadesh, where everybody was. Vayashiva osam davar. And they gave them a report. See, here I'm not sure, because Rashi says, Vayashiva osam davar es Moshe v'es Aaron. So I'm wondering if Rashi means to say that first they did report to Moshe and Aaron. Then the Eskalaida. Because that's the question that I asked. What, did they first give a report to Moshe and Aaron before they spoke to the people? Rashi over here, Plain Shah, seems to be indicating that they did. In my opinion, to try and give some kind of an answer, let's assume they did speak. So if they did speak, the question is, why did Moshe then give them permission to speak to the entire people? So I would say that they were very clever. I would say they were very clever, and they kept it hidden. They kept their plot hidden. I mean, there's Rashis that indicate that Moshe was suspicious and Yoshua was suspicious and so on and so forth. But according to the plain shot, it makes sense to say that they didn't share what they were planning to do. They kept it maybe amongst themselves, but they were very shrewd in keeping it away from Yoshua and Kalev. Had Yoshua and Kalev knew, then they would have stopped them. They would have gone to Moshe and told them, don't let them speak. And then Moshe would have had to deal with them one way or another. So I'm saying that they were very clever, and they gave out the right signals. Or maybe in the presence of Moshe, they didn't have the guts to say anything like that. But then when they were in front of the people, it finally came out. They couldn't subdue it any longer. They couldn't control themselves. It was a very powerful feeling. And then it came out. So what happened? Vayisaprulo. We came to the land that you sent us. And also there they agreed, it's a beautiful land, flows with milk and honey, because that period, and they showed the fruits. So here, it sounds like a positive thing. But Rashi says, the most effective liars are the ones that start off with the truth. And if you want to be believed, you have to establish your credentials, your integrity. And, it's a tremendous, it's great land. Efes ki azam. Now, efes becomes a very big word. Efes means however, or but. The people are strong. Hayoshev v'aretz, that dwell there. V'arim b'tzuros, g'dolos miyod. And the cities are extremely fortified. V'gam yalid ve'ho anak re'inusham. And also the descendants of the Anak, this ancient race of giants, we saw there. Amalek, Yoshev, Beretz, and Negev. Amalek, they pick Amalek, because Amalek was an attacker of theirs, was a known enemy. V'yachiti, v'yavuzar, Yoshev, Bahar, v'aknani, Yoshev, al-yam, v'yad, hayardim, and turmoil breaks out. So the Ramban says, what did they do wrong? I mean, they're telling the truth. Truth of the matter is, in the Devarim, you see Moshe, when Moshe is talking about the entry to the land, he says how powerful they are, and so on and so forth. And even, more extreme terms than the spies use. So you see, by Yahas, Kalev Esalano Moshe, Kalev gets up and shuts the people down. They were all beginning to grumble and question and challenge. The panic already, he had so panicked. But what did he say that was so terrible? So the Ramban says that the word Ephes, the word Ephes means nothing, means zero, nothing. So by implication, what they meant to convey was, yeah, it's a very, very nice land, but it's an impossibility. It's nothing. It's all going to be nothing. Can't. In other words, that sense of disillusionment, that sense of discouragement, that's very contagious. They communicated the idea that it's all in vain, and it's an impossibility. We'll never be able to conquer it, and it had its effect. So I would say like this: at this point in time, you see already the fate of the Meraglim, because what were they doing over here? They were distorting the entire nature of the mission, of the spying mission. See, there's two kinds of spying mission. One spying mission is we're going to do a reconnaissance, and then we'll see on the basis of what we see, we'll decide whether we're going to attack or not. That's the normal situation. Yeah, but this was not like that. The decision of whether we're going to go or not, that's been taken. That's not up for grabs. That's not why we sent the spies. That decision was made by the Kodesh Baruch Hu, and that's it. That's an absolute. So what do you have the spies? Oh, the spies, that's to carry it out. It's in our hands to carry it out. We have to make decisions. But it never was intended to be a mission with the purpose of, now we're going to decide, can we do it or can't we do it? That's they distorted it. They transformed it into a mission to provide the information of whether we're going to attack or not. That's the chait. That's the chait. That decision was already taken. Okay. So what happened over here? So you see that that they countered it. Now Kalev. Now Kalev gets up and he says, "Alo nala b'yirashnu." Let us go up and inherit it. What are you talking about? We can do it. He's trying to counter the effects of what the Meraglim said. And the other people said, "Lo." So you have this debate, this argument that's going on. The 10 spies are saying it's an impossibility, and Kalev and Yoshua are saying, "What are you talking about? We'll be able to do it." See, so the Ramban explains what's going on. That the spies operated in two phases. In the first phase, they tried to use intimidation, fear. We're going to get slaughtered. This whole thing is a big mistake. Okay? But that was not enough. I mean, the people didn't just all agree. Because then you had Yoshua and you had Kalev. These are two great people. And they got up and they said, "It's absolutely ridiculous. We can do it. Don't worry about it." So now the people were thrown into doubt. And that's by a Rugnu, you know, Devarma tells us, you know, in the tents, and they talked, they complained. They didn't know what to do. They were thrown completely off of balance. So what happened next? Now, because the question we asked was, what is the relationship between the intimidation, between the fear, and the Dibas Ha'aretz? Here comes the Dibas Ha'aretz. Vayotziu Dibas Ha'aretz Asher Tarau Osa. And they brought out the Lashon Hara about the land that they had spied. El Bnei Yisrael Lamar. See, now they sing a different tune. Now they attack the land. At first, their point of attack was the might of the inhabitants. Okay, that was countered. Now they come in from a different angle. And they sort of revised what they had said about the land. They said, Now they find all the problem with the land. It's a land that consumes its inhabitants. It's not for us. It's a very dangerous kind of a land. It's a crazy kind of land. Rashi says, we saw a lot of funerals. We saw a lot of funerals happening at that time. So Rashi says, yeah, because that was a diversion. Hashem brought about a lot of those funerals in order that the people would be diverted. They'd be preoccupied with burial. They wouldn't notice them. And they took that and they used that. Oh, there's something wrong with this land. All the people that we saw there were men of a great, great dimension, great measure. which at first glance could be a little contradictory. What are you telling us? It consumes the habitants, but then it produces these mighty war warriors. What are you talking about? So that, but they knew what they were doing. As the Mefarshim explained, that the point was to communicate there is something very strange here, very unusual. It's not a normal place. This is, yeah, it's completely different. It consumes its inhabitants unless you're this unique type of people that can withstand it. Only giants can live here, not ordinary. We're not giants. We're plain people. We're not that strong. We'll never be able to survive. So they destroyed the entire idea that the Jews had, that had been implanted in them, that there's an Eretz Zavos Chol Advash. No one ever said that it's a horrible place. It's a great, great place. That pretty much was the decisive blow. After that, they couldn't recuperate. Then they again go back. V'sham reinu asanafilim, v'nehanak, minanafilim, v'anehi b'yeinenu kachagavu. We felt like we were grasshoppers compared to them, and that's how they felt as well. Either they projected that, or Rashi says they heard them whispering that, who are these little grasshoppers over here? Then, v'tisa kol eda, v'yitnu es kolam, v'yifku ha'am balai lehu. That really brought about a complete devastation. Then, v'yilonu al Moshe al-Aaron, kol b'nei Yisrael. Then they complained against him, and they all said, lumasnu b'eretz Mitzrayim. Would that we had died in the land of Egypt. Oh, b'midbar hazeh lumasnu, or in this wilderness. Complete disaster. We're going to get killed. We're better off. Let's go back to Mitzrayim. So you see that there was a complete meltdown. You can see how serious. That's it. They rejected God. They rejected the entire liberation from Mitzrayim. We'll go back and we'll be slaves again in Egypt. So what's going on over here? How did these two factors come together? I guess it has to do with the fact that Moshe had instructed them to bring back a report about the land. And we need to ask, well, why? They had the information already. God had told them that it's a goodly land. So why did they have to bring back a report about the quality of the land and so on and so forth, the trees? So I would say that Moshe, I believe the Ramban makes this point as well. See that there's two things. It wouldn't be an easy thing. The conquest of the land would be a difficult thing for them. It would require a tremendous amount of effort, a tremendous amount of courage, in spite of all the miracles. It's true, you see miracles. But now you're telling them to, in the past, when they fought, their backs were against the wall. When they fought against Amalek, the backs were against the wall. That's one thing. But to turn around and assume the role of a conqueror and an invader against these very entrenched and these powerful nations, that's a different kind of a challenge. I mean, nevertheless, Hashem expected them to be able to do it. So I think that in these types of situations, I mean, it's always when you contemplate, it's a risk. When you contemplate taking a risk, you always have risk reward. Everybody, before you make an investment or whatever it is, it's the risk. You try to calculate the risk, and then there's the reward. Okay, so this was a big risk. You're going on a huge challenge over here. But what's the reward? Oh, it's a great land. So if they have that feeling that we're not just doing this for anything, this is something so different and unique and special, so it becomes much easier to take the risk. It's worth fighting for. It's worth fighting for. This is worth fighting for. See, but the more, that's why Moshe Rabbeinu wanted, that's why they bring back the fruits of the land. Because the more they see what a great land it is, and that these are people without a land, they were slaves in Egypt, then they were in the wilderness, now they're going to have a land of their own, but not just any land, it's going to be a great land. So Moshe wanted them to be reinforced. Okay, and they wanted to. Behind the request, it wasn't just for military. There was a desire, we want to see. What kind of land are we getting? Of course, this was a big, big mistake. Hashem is indicating, I told them it's good. You don't have to see for yourself. This should have been part of your amunah. And it's very dangerous, because once you're given an opportunity to let people go and see, there's going to be people that are going to see negative things as well. Not everybody is optimistic. Okay? So what happened was as follows. The spies were very, very shrewd. Their intention was clearly to intimidate, to create panic and fear, we're not going to, can't go ahead. That's it. This is a big mistake. But they saw that that necessarily is not going to, that's why they started off with, oh, the land is very good, but the land is very good, Ephes, but it's an impossibility. That's the seed that they planted. But Yoshua and Caleb, mainly Caleb, came back and they said, what are you talking about? We can do it. So then they were thrown into it. Now maybe we should go along with them. They didn't just give up every remnant, every aspect of courage and confidence at once. So that's when the spies came in with the killer, with the body blow. They said, no, it's not just that, but this land is not for us. They broke down that whole, I'll use the word fantasy. It wasn't a fantasy because it was based upon the Dvar Hashem, but that whole feeling you have in your mind, you're looking forward to it. It's a great, great place. They broke that down. It's not so great. And yeah, look at these tremendous roots. They took everything that was positive and turned it into a negative. And once that happened, then they were like that. Because already they're afraid. But why, you know, they're lacking in confidence. They don't have the courage. But now, if the whole thing is not worth it in the first place, in fact, if not that, it's a liability. We don't even know if we can survive here because it's an Eretz HaChel Yishbah. Once they distorted the picture of the land and they communicated to them the idea that the land was a bad land, end of game. That was the end of the story. So that was the chait. According, that's what Rashi, I believe, means. You see, that's what Rashi means. That it's two aspects. Their avera consisted of two things. One was their rebelliousness against the Tzivu Hashem. That we can't go. We're going to lose. We're going to get killed. When Hashem said, you're going to go. You'll be victorious. They were overcome by fear and panic. But the other aspect of it was Diba, Lashon Hara. So one second, we asked the question before, Miriam, they didn't learn from Miriam, but Miriam spoke about a person. Miriam spoke about a brother, which is Lashon Hara. Her intentions were good and so on and so forth, but for a person on her level, it was Lashon. But they're talking about a land, and how does that fit the definition of Lashon Hara? I just want to say over, I discussed this with Rabbi Chade many years ago. In the early years of the yeshiva, I gave a shiur on the Meraglim. And I've been taking up the subject time and time again over the years. And I asked them this question about Lashon Hara. How do you have Lashon Hara for a land? So he liked the question, and it's been a long time. So whatever answer I give you, it's my spin. I always, not his exact words. But this is how I got the answer. This is what I heard. So you said like this, that Lashon Hara is not necessarily about a person, but Lashon Hara is where a person distorts the nature of an object or the nature of an entity. And the motivation behind that is because he doesn't want to face up to a weakness in himself. So rather than face up to a weakness in yourself, you blame the object. It's that person's fault, or it's that, you see? And that was the chait of Miriam, apparently. I mean, she was on the highest possible level, but to a certain extent, it bothered her that Moshe Rabbeinu separated from his wife. And he did this because of his level of nevuah was different, was above anybody else's, even Aaron and Miriam. They didn't realize that. They realized that his level of nevuah was higher, but not in such a dramatic way. That he was on such a level that he could not live a normal marital life anymore. But they could. That was their argument. God spoke to us too, but when we carry on with normal life, you see, so they, apparently that was a problem. To be able to acknowledge that he was so different, that Moshe was so different than them that they weren't even in the same class, and the Rambam has a separate ikar for the Nevuah and then for the Nevuah of Moshe. That apparently was too difficult for them. So they therefore had to blame it on Moshe. There's something he did wrong over here. So the same thing over here. And that is that the spies were guilty. They had a weakness. That weakness came out. Maybe they weren't aware of it. A person doesn't know his strengths, doesn't know his weaknesses until he asks, life is a challenge. That's a nisayon. That's what an assignment is. When you face a situation, it doesn't mean that God set it up. You face a situation that tests you. Up until here, I can do it. I can deal with it. But this was, they faced the situation and they couldn't deal with it. I'm taking it at face value. I'm not looking for deeper psychological reasons, explanation as to why they acted this way. I'm just taking it at face value that they, I think it's plausible. They were blinded by what they saw. They saw this mighty nation and they lost their courage. They're going to have to go in the and fight in the battle. And their children and their families and so on and so forth. But that was a weakness. Rather than come to Moshe and say, this is what happened to us. We just fell apart. Don't have us speak, recuse. Sometimes you have to recuse yourself. Sometimes we're faced with a challenge. If someone wants us to do something or whatever it is, maybe you're a rabbi, maybe you're giving a shit, but you can't do it. You don't have the knowledge, you don't have the, there are times in life when you have to say, I can't do this. I can't solve this problem. Then you're not guilty. Had the spies come honestly and said, listen, the way we look at it, forget about it. I can't move. I'm paralyzed. So then either Moshe would have talked to them, whatever it is, or they would have been forgiven. He would not have allowed them to take the microphone, of course. But their hate was that they couldn't accept that about themselves. So rather than say that we have the problem, we're cowards, they had, no, it's not us, it's the situation. The situation is no good. The land is no good. This whole thing is no good. You see, that's projecting your own flaw, your own defect, onto the situation rather than face it in yourself. And he said that's the essence of Lashon Hara. That's why Lashon Hara destroys you. Because without the Lashon Hara, you'd be forced to confront what's within you and deal with it, and you could grow from that. But if you are saved from the necessity of doing that, and all you have to do is to blame it on others, they're the problem. That's what Chazal said. Me kala posel bimumo posel. Whoever finds flaws in others, where does it come from? From his own mom, from his own defect. So what does a person do? Instead of looking at himself, he's just blaming others for his defect. So that's the role. That's the role that Lashon Hara played. So the two merge together. The two aspects of the sin. The lack, the fear, the lack of courage. And that led them to speak badly about the land. The Lashon Hara situation. But again, and that was the... See, that was the linchpin. And I think that's why the punishment, we said before, the punishment was like, was it until the entire generation passes away, or was it 40 years? Yom Lashana. So I would say that's the Israeli Hainu Hach. That is to say that those people that left Mitzrayim, those people that were implicated in this, they would die. But Hashem would work it out that it would, because it could have been 42 years, it could have been, but Hashem would work it out that it would be 40 years, because that represents their flaw. That they, 40 years, 40 days, that they couldn't trust Hashem, they had to see for themselves. Once they needed to see for themselves, they opened themselves up to this possibility of getting the bad report and being intimidated from fulfilling the mitzvah. Okay, now, I want to deal with that other issue to try and understand why they didn't listen. Take a look at Moshe. As I said, in Devarim, we find Moshe addressing them, which is not recorded in Shalach. The question is, like, why didn't they have Amunah of Hashem? They had experience. When we read it, we find it hard to believe. Look at all the miracles that you've seen. And why wouldn't you have confidence that Hashem could do this for you? So, then go now to the Devarim Perek Aleph, where he recounts it. But they rugged b'yaleichem. You spoke, you moaned, you wailed in your tents, and you said, "B'sinas Hashem osano." This is an amazing pasuk. Because God hates us, He took us out of Egypt to give us into the hands of the Amori to destroy us. To where are we going? Our brothers have intimidated, have melted our hearts, saying it's a great and mighty nation, more mighty than us, and cities that are fortified up to the heavens, and also the sons of giants. Then you see the Moshe in Pasuk Chavtes. Moshe says, "Lo sartzon v'lo sirun." They have, don't be afraid of them. Hashem Elokeichem Aholeh Lefnechem. God is going with you. Who Yilachim Lechem? He's going to fight for you. I mean, he's recounting these obvious things, everything you saw in Egypt. You saw it with your own eyes. And then the Midbar, he carried you like a person carries his child. Until you came to this place. And in this matter, you don't believe in God. Who goes before you on the road, to choose out a place so you can camp in a fire at night, to point to show you the way. I mean, you see the closest of Hashem, he's right there, he's protecting you, and so on. What's your problem? And then he says that Hashem heard the sound of your words, and he got angry, and he swore, in Yira Ishban Hashem, that not one of these people of this generation would see that goodly land that I swore to give to your fathers, except for Kalev, and he'll actually inherit the area that he tread, that he spied out, which was Hebron, and because he followed Hashem, and so on. And then your children, that you said would be spoils, that they'll inherit it, and so on. So what's going on over here? All this is true. And the people did witness all of these miracles. And as far as I can see, this is not that different. What would there be about this that would be impossible for God to do that he hadn't already done? He could afflict them in any way that he wanted, if that would be the case. Or they, unbeknownst to them, it's interesting. With all of this, I mean, it is interesting, but it's a separate question. Because 40 years later, Yoshua sends out spies, and the report is that they're completely frozen in fear, the inhabitants of Jericho. All the inhabitants of the land were like paralyzed and afraid of the Jews. So that's the extent to which they distorted the situation. The reality was that they were afraid of the Jews. See, but I would say like this, and I think this is one of the important lessons of the story. And what exactly is Amunah? So if you asked any of the Jews, do you believe that Hashem can defeat the nations of Canaan or not? Do you think that they're too powerful and Hashem just doesn't have the ability to do it? I think they all would have said, of course God can do it. And they would have brought down all of these proofs. They would say the same things we're saying. They knew. See, there's two aspects to Emunah. One is the abstract, intellectual aspect. So there are people, I mean, there are Ma'amin v'Eino Ma'amin. There's a concept of a believer and not a believer at the same time. Like, for example, it says that Noah boarded the ark, Mipnei Me'amavol, from before the waters of the Mavol. So Rashi says, what does that mean, from before the waters? All right, this is a midrash. Not the plain meaning, but it means he didn't get on the ark until he felt it started to rain already. It was raining. He felt the drops. Then Chazal said he was a mammon and ain't no mammon. He believed, but he didn't believe. Why? Because he had to feel the rain itself. Yeah, but why did he? Why didn't he get on earlier, before it started raining, and get on board and get comfortable and so on and so forth, and then sit outside and watch the rain start? Now, there was a part of him that resisted. He wasn't entirely convinced. So you see that it's not an absolute thing. Do you believe or don't you believe? No, it's not so pushy. There's elements of belief and there's elements of denial. You see, that's not emunah shalema. Because the real objective is a belief which permeates all of one's emotions. And that becomes his reality. That removes his fear. He's completely confident that he will be successful, that God's protecting him. And he's not afraid. Or he can be, let's put it this way, it's not a sin to be afraid. But he's able to quell the fear. His knowledge and emunah in Hashem gives him the strength to overcome the fear. Okay, so look, there's different levels. So Daniel can enter into the Gov HaRayos. He can enter into the cave with a lot of lions. That's the extent of his emunah. and other people can manifest their emunah. But you see, there's different situations. Yeah, a person can have emunah, but what about when you're on the battlefield and there's tanks and explosions and people are dying? Do you still have emunah? Some people, yes. Yes, I mean, you see, there's heroic people, there's courageous people. They're motivated. But there are people that simply, it's too much of a challenge. It can overstep. It could be, you could be in a situation which is beyond your capacity. Of course, God knows that. God is not going to put a person in a situation which is completely beyond his capacity. If that's the case, he doesn't have Bechira. But that's a matter for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Question would be, did the Jews have Bechira in this situation? Could they go into the land and witness what they witnessed and still sit back and say, we could do it? That's what, that's what Kali says. Ki yochol nuchola, we could do it. We've seen the same thing you've seen, and we have every confidence that we're able to do it. See, they reached the proper level of emunah. But I think what it means over here is that not that they were disbelievers, not that they didn't believe in Hashem, but it was limited. It didn't permeate everything, well, their emotions. They didn't perfect themselves to reach this level where they would be able to be conquering the land. And that was the chait. So there were, I would say one more thing in terms of the lack of emunah. See, because it's a very fascinating pasuk over here. And that pasuk is that they said something which is so strange. So you got to read the psukim carefully. What does this mean when they said that b'sinas Hashem osano? How's that? God hates us? God hates us and that's why he took us out of Mitzrayim? That's how you can be distorted. You can reinterpret history. The reason why God did all those miracles and brought the Egyptians to their knees for our sake is because he hates us. And the whole purpose is to give us over into the hands of the Amori that they should destroy us. Look at the extent to which they distorted reality. It's a frightening kind of a thing. I mean, it's one thing to say, I can't do it, I'm afraid. It's another thing, I don't believe that God hates me. It's the same idea. Instead of looking within, you project without. That's actually how Rashi understands that. And Rashi understands that they were projecting their own emotions. Rashi says, "B'sinas Hashem osanu." So Rashi says, "V'hu haya oiv eschem." He loves you. Avalatem sonim oso, but you hate him. Moshal hed yoromer. What's in your heart, you project onto your friend. That's how Rashi learns it. But the Sephardo gives another shot. The Sephardo gives another shot, which is very, very significant, and it helps us to understand why they did not have the emunah that they should have had. And he says that they meant it. B'sinas Hashem osanu, God hates us, says the Sephardo. Al ma she'avadnu avodas gilulin b'mitzrayim. Wow. That was coming back to haunt them. Maybe they had excessive guilt, but they were saying that this is really a punishment. In other words, it wasn't a completely irrational statement, because it sounds crazy to say that God hates you, and it sounds crazy, especially after he's done all these things for you. So they had to somehow justify it. So they found. See, when a person has this disposition, he can find things. When a person, see, sometimes a person feels that a bunch of bad things, bad things are happening to him and so on and so forth. He thinks he's getting punished by Hashem. So then he starts to, you know, look into himself. He has excessive guilt. He'll come up with anything he may have done in the past. Yeah, but didn't you do tshuva for that? They didn't have a rational perspective anymore. True, they had worshipped Avodah Zarah, but there were causes and so on and so forth. But apparently Hashem had forgiven them. There's no indication that Hashem had not forgiven them for the Avodah Zarah. They worshipped when they were slaves or before that time. It would appear that everything had changed now. They brought the Karban Pesach, which essentially is destroying the deity of the Mitzrayim. It's a renunciation of Avodah Zarah. And then they accepted the Torah and the mitzvos and the Aseret HaDibros. So whatever happened in the past, apparently Hashem said, now go up and conquer. But in their irrational state, their old sins, especially what is there, came back to haunt them. That too would be a factor in causing a loss of Emunah. Because Emunah depends upon two things. Once you have to have a complete conviction in the truthfulness and the reality of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his providence, his Hashgacha, but you have to have a certain confidence in yourself. So to a certain extent over here, it appears that they didn't view themselves as worthy of God's protection, of God's providence. So it's a combination of factors. So that's one of the takeaways. There's a couple of takeaways over here. It's, of course, every parsha in Chumash is extremely important in searching for the lessons that applies to us, and to internalize those lessons. And the two is that the Emunah, we work on our Emunah, it has to be not just an abstract Emunah, but we should reach the level where just a Mamon, and remove those traces of Eino Mamon that may reside within us, and to work out those areas, to live our lives in accordance. We have certain things that are difficult for us to do, or certain things, mitzvot, that may evoke fear in us, and then you have to really summon the Emunah factor and train yourself to overcome those fears. So you become a person who lives in accordance with his Emunah. Right? Isn't that the pasuk? I forget where it is now. Tzadik b'Emunah? Tichya, something like that. Tzadik lives by his Emunah. And the other point is very, very important, that that mechanism of not projecting your own flaws onto others. We should be very, very cognizant of the kind of criticisms we're constantly giving out, what the types of lashon hara we may be attracted to, because that tells us a great deal about ourselves. Why does that please us to hear that type of a thing about somebody else? Is there something specific that I feel weak about, or I feel nervous about, and when I hear somebody else, it makes me feel superior? It absolves me from the need to look within myself. Those are two very important lessons. That mechanism, when that desire to say something about somebody else comes into play, stop, don't say it, but rather look within yourself and ask yourself why. What is the pleasure my saying? What pleasure will it give to me? What weakness or insecurity within me will it alleviate for me? It won't alleviate it, just temporary reprieve. But then you get more sunk in that. Okay, now, as I said, I want to see if I can address, this will be the last point. And that is, I asked the question, as I said, it's not really that bothersome a question, it just occurred to me. I think it's a legitimate question. And that is that why is the ultimate conquest when the Jews conquered Eretz Yisrael under Yeshua, that's not included in Chamish Shechem Shetor. That's in Tanakh. That's the first episode in Tanakh. But in terms of the content, it seems that the story of the conquest was intended to be in Chamish Shechem Shetor, because I'm saying that it's the subject of Bamidbar and the spies. And if it turned out differently, then the Torah would tell us that they went up and they conquered the land. So, okay, it didn't turn out that way, but they did conquer the land. So why isn't the conquest of the land included? So I want to suggest as follows, that it wasn't the conquest of the land per se that was intended to be included, but it would be Kibush Moshe. Kibush Moshe would have been a different phenomenon. And perhaps that's one of the reasons Chazal say, why did Moshe was constantly praying with Hashem to allow him to enter, to partake of the conquest? Okay, because of mitzvot and so forth, but I'm saying this is another dimension. Chazal indicate that if Moshe would have conquered the land, it would have been a completely different thing. And they say he would have built the base of Mikdash and it never would have been destroyed, and so on and so forth. Now, whether they meant it literally or they're just indicating an idea, but it means the whole course of Jewish history would have been different. Because that would have been the ultimate conquest. And that conquest, the Moshe, is a different kind of conquest. The way he would have dealt with things and set things up and so on and so forth would have been different. And as great as Yeshua was, And his conquest wasn't perfect. His conquest wasn't complete. I mean, you see, it wasn't complete. And they didn't do everything they had to do. People got tired and they stopped fighting wars and they allowed the Goyim to remain amongst them and it became a stumbling block for Avodah Zarah. So it wasn't the ultimate conquest. And you can see, look, take the situation today where if those who regard, all right, so let's assume with the help of Hashem, the return to Eretz Yisrael, and the restoration of sovereignty of the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael, and their ability to defend themselves, and so on and so forth. So these are all great things. Yeah, but it's not the ultimate conquest. It has its problems as well. They're confronted with numerous problems and enemies within, without, and so on and so forth. So it's wonderful. You have to give Hodoya Lashem, and to the extent that a person can come here and be part of it and strengthen it, it's a great, great thing. I'm just saying it's not the ultimate conquest. And perhaps, well, we don't know. We don't have Nevi'im. Perhaps Hashem allowed us. Look, if you want to go on your own and have a movement, and fine, I'm not going to stop you. But if the conquest was engineered by Hashem and Mashiach, whatever it is, we can assume it would have been different. Okay, I don't know. I'm just saying that I think that what we were waiting for in Bamidbar was Moshe Rabbeinu's conquest, and that would have been included in Chamisha Chumshei Torah. And the entire course of Jewish history would have been different. But unfortunately, that didn't come about. There's many, many things. Didn't come about exactly as they were supposed to, but that's no cause for despair. I mean, the Jewish history, the Jewish movement continues, and we have every confidence that it'll work itself out. And hopefully today we're closer to that goal, and we'll implement the ideas of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the land of Eretz Yisrael. Okay, guys. Okay, fellas and girls, Rabbi ladies Mann. And gentlemen.
Rabbi Mann.
Yes.
I'd like to offer a proof in Rashi to your explanation of why it wasn't included, why Yeshua wasn't included there.
Okay.
Like I said, so by Rashi, by the Meraglim, once he leaves over, tells over their punishment. He says that their tongues grew long, and like a worm, and it went into their navel. That was their punishment, and they died. So what's shot of that, Rashi? So I wanted to say that, of course, the tongue represents Lashon Hara. But why does it go into the navel and kill them? Because the navel is the umbilical cord of a child, like the birth of a child. And Eretz Yisrael, if we all went in to Eretz Yisrael with Moshe Rabbeinu, we would have been a new nation, born of under the hashgacha of Moshe Rabbeinu and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we would have prospered differently if the Meraglim hadn't killed us with their Lashon Hara. We would have continued differently, and if Moshe Rabbeinu would have set up the land, we would have not lost the base of the Mikdash. Our history would have been different. That's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. It's an excellent point because you see that the incident of the spies had a tremendous impact of the on the future of the nation. So Hashem said, "You cried a bechiah shel chinam, but it's going to be a bechiah ledoros." So it had tremendous consequences for the future, and that ultimately it leads to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. The spies did have an impact. It did have an effect not just on individuals but on the nation as well. So, that's the basic idea. That had they overcome that, had they not succumbed to that, it would have been a completely different the Jewish future. In many, many ways, you could see that in a broader sense, it affects the Jews even today. I'm just putting this out there. I mean, but in many areas, you see that there's a certain fear of what the Goyim will say. That deep-rooted fear that I think so. I mean, I'm not criticizing anybody. But you see it in certain political acts or movements or expressions that there is that element that the Jews are really afraid to stand up for what they believe in. I mean, when I say afraid, I mean, it's a certain extent. It's not like completely afraid. But you see that there's a very basic, very powerful need to get the approval of the guy. Okay.
Rabbi
Mann. Okay, everybody. Yes.
A quick question. Yes? The pasuk is talking about the reaction of Am, and it makes it sound like every single last person cried. Every single person said, we want to go back to Mitzrayim. Hashem hates us. They all wanted to stone Kalev and Yoshua. How is it? It doesn't seem plausible that every single person had that reaction. Is it just saying in generalities that, like, most of them or the ones that should have known better? Because I can understand, like, every last person had fear and guilt in their own way. But how is it possible that they were, like, one unified voice of crying and of saying these things that, you know?
I would tend to agree. I don't think you have to assume every single one. I mean, the Evan Ezra says in certain places that it means, I would say it means that the bulk, this was the prevailing attitude. So sometimes when something is very pervasive, you'll say, oh boy, they were all the people were against it. Not every individual, we didn't take a poll. So there must have been Yechidim, or it's certainly possible to say that there were individuals that didn't go along with it, but they were canceled out. They didn't have any real clout. If you're going to look at the Das HaKo, you know, the public view, that was it. That represented the public view. And so on and so forth. That's how you have to understand these things. Okay.
Rabbi Mann, can I just ask one more question?
Yeah, sure.
Can you just explain maybe what was that the Meraglim's actions, how did that affect B'nai Yisrael, and that B'nai Yisrael were also punished for the Meraglim's actions, and that resulted in them not going into Eretz Yisrael?
Well, what do you mean, the ones at that time?
Yeah, that generation, what happened? You know, meaning at the end of the day, it was really the Meraglim who sinned. I mean, B'nai Yisrael, they were just affected by their words. They were corrupt.
Well, yeah, so that affects you. That affects your attitude and so on and so forth. This is a very significant thing. And when you're faced with a challenge, it can be a decisive thing. If you summon the ability to do the right thing and you do it, you overcome your fear. You're a different person. It's not just that one thing that you did. You now have a different mentality. On the other hand, if you start to cave in, so that has its consequences too. And you lower yourself to a different level, and it has consequences in many areas. If a person fails to live up to a challenge, and he's overcome by his emotions, his rationalization, and so on and so forth. So it's not just that one thing. Now, all the subsequent challenges that you face, it's going to be from a diminished stature. It has an effect. That's how I take it.
Not just that
particular thing, but this is a definitive kind of thing, transformational kind of thing.
Not just
for you either, it's for the whole people. I mean, a people has a certain culture, it has a certain attitude, it has a certain strength, it has certain characteristics, obviously. You can generalize about people too, very carefully. You can speak about Jews, certain strengths that they have. You could also find certain flaws that are pretty much common to the Jewish mentality. And that's the sense in which I'm talking.
Meaning, in other words, you're saying that effect was very critical, that they just weren't ready to conquer Eretz Yisrael in that generation?
They weren't ready, correct.
But they weren't,
you know, they didn't reach that level of Emuna. And then they acted a certain way, and they cried, and then they, you know, and so on and so forth. It's a pretty pervasive thing. It's not a small thing, obviously. No one's perfect. We all have failures. Doesn't mean that it's the end of the world. You know, you still get back on your game, so to speak. But this was more than just a failure.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, sure. Okay, really, everybody.
Man?
Yeah, okay.
Sorry. The idea that with Rashi, the Anashim, that they were Ksherim at that time, how does that fit into sort of this framework in terms of the Ma'aminim, Ma'aminim? Is something changed between the time they left and when they got into the land?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I say you don't know yourself. You don't know yourself. And you may think until you face certain challenges that you can't live up to. Yeah, they were Ksherim. Had they not asked for the spies, that's what, in a sense of a Rashi quotes Hashem is saying, I told them it was good. Had they not had the spies, they'd all been better off. They would not have had this problem. Because we do see that the people the inhabitants of Canaan were paralyzed. They were scared. Ultimately, it wasn't a tough battle. So that all of their projections were wrong. Had they somehow been saved from this, they would have been tzaddikim. It's interesting. You see that idea that sometimes the situation can be determinative. You see that by Chanoch. I was just talking about it yesterday with the Rosenthals. We learned Chumash. So the Chanoch, it says that he that time they were living till close to 1,000. He was in the 300, and because Hashem took him away. So Rashi says that God knew that the challenges of the Dor HaMavol would be too great for him. So he would fail. So Hashem took him away. Okay. So that means to say sometimes death is a good. It was better for him that he died then before he faced these situations which he couldn't, he would not be able to withstand, and he would become a Rasha. So yeah, they would tzaddikim. But it can happen very quickly. When you're confronted with a certain situation that is way beyond you, or it's not beyond, as I said, of course, Hashem would have put them in a situation if they didn't have Bechira. But this was a weak spot for them. And yeah, they started out as tzaddikim, but they were punished right away. They didn't last long. It's a scary thing. You gotta be careful. Okay.
Yeah, great year. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Rabbi Man.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ellie. Yeah. All right. Okay, guys. Be well. Nice being together with you again.
Yes, same here.
On Zoom. Thank you. So what do I do? Just tap it?
Yeah.